Welcome, everybody, to this week's installment of Jewish Art. We are going to be discussing how birds play into art in general, specifically, primarily to Jewish art. So before we actually jump into the PowerPoint, I want to ask everybody, what are your questions you have about use about birds in art and in Tanakh in general? Like, what would you be curious about? Like, which birds? Feel free to unmute.
Dove.
Doves, okay. What are other ones?
I couldn't hear. What did you say?
She said doves. You're not.
Oh, doves and eagles. There is eagle a lot.
Right.
Dove and eagle are the main. Yeah.
The Perushim don't say nice things about crows on the ark.
All right, crows, ravens, right? Let's know rave, yeah. Right? So we're going to get into those and see exactly what each of what those are. We will not be going to all the birds mentioned in Tanakh because, well, it is only we only have so much time, and to go through all of those is many, many books. Which, yeah. So again, we'll try and do some of them. If there are enough that aren't covered, people want another it to be another installment of it. Let me know. We can tack that on for next week.
There's a national bird of the state of Israel.
Yes, the hoop. Who?
Duchifat.
Yes. Hupo. Yes. Sorry. Yes. So yeah. So we're going to be discussing that one because that is a pretty one. It's not the extent of its usage in general is that it's just not kosher, and then we move on. In terms of its usage in general, it's not like we have it in art a lot. It's like no. Right. It's one of the it's a modern one that Israelis like, but it's not like historically a significant one. So we're going to ignore that one. Yeah, so we will get to one second. Okay, so let's start from the beginning.
Did you mention the Orev?
Yes, we did.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right. Also, if some things are unclear because of the translation, so we're going to be starting by referring to the words as they come up first in Hebrew, and then then explaining their translation, because for a lot of them, there's a huge debate as to what exactly each of them mean.
And have we discussed Nesher in the past?
It has come up in passing. We discussed the griffin because part of the griffin are the wings of a nesher. So we discussed. So then the parts we discussed about that we are not going to discuss. We're going to discuss other elements of it today. So we're discussing Jewish birds. So again, so just a little bit overall perspective on types of birds. So one question is whether or not birds are kosher or not kosher. So we are not. So that's primarily discussed in Vayikra, as well as in Dvarim, is a list of non-kosher birds. And there's an expansion of that in the Gemara where they describe the features of knowing what kosher birds are, and they discuss how you have to have a tradition in order to slaughter birds. So we're not going to be discussing that because this is not a shir on kashrut and what are the yummy birds to eat. For more on that, I recommend you search Ari Zivotofsky and Turkey, and he has an excellent article where he goes through it all extremely in depth and thoroughly. If you're interested in learning more about the history of the traditions and what are kosher animals and birds.
It's also mentioned without a name, but in general, let's say the mitzvah of Kan Tzipor.
Right, of sending away the mother bird. Right, so that is also something, but that is not what we're going to be discussing because it tends to not be a motif in art. Meaning as in, there is a lot to discuss about what is the nature of that mitzvah, which again, which a future point we can get to, but as far as limit on our time, I don't think we're going to have time to cover that. So what we're going to aim to cover are four birds, namely the onah, the dove, the orev, the raven, the nesher, and the knaf rananim. The reason why those last two are in Hebrew is because they're very hotly debated as to what on earth those are. And as far as there also are some birds that are not birds you'll ever actually find in your life, that are a little more fantastical, such as the phoenix, griffin, dragon, rock, ziz, and bar yochni, which we covered in brief during the supernatural series. So also given we didn't cover it in this series as well. We're not going to go back over the supernatural ones. If there's some at the end of a question about them, I can try and answer it. We're going to try and focus on those four birds, because those are birds that you will most likely see in both in modern art and in ancient art. Whereas the other ones are a little bit less common and also aren't necessarily birds per se. So I wouldn't necessarily put those in the same category because those are, again, not natural. So as far as, you know, usage that we've just seen recently, so again, we have discussed the griffin. Also, we've also discussed the bird's head of gutta. So the question is, so, you know, why would you want to replace a human head with a bird? So we discussed that as far as, you know, why it couldn't be human, but as far as why bird specifically, so part of that will relate to what we think traits are in birds, whether that may be positive or negatively, which we'll discuss as well.
Yeah, that's from the bird's Haggadah.
Correct, the bird's Haggadah, right? So the first one we're going to be discussing is the dove and the raven. So as far as the positive connotations for the dove, right, so those are, they're plentiful both in the Tanakh as well as in other cultures as well. Right, it's known as an animal of peace. Right, it's also, you know, one of the korbanot. It's also one of the more frequently eaten animals. That's why people have dove coats, right? So it's one of the very highly domesticated and eaten animals. But as far as its usage in art, as opposed to simply being put there because, hey, it's tasty. So one of the main reasons why it'd be put is because of its associations and connotations, and it has based on the story with Noah. So this is after the flood, where Noah is on the table trying to see when it's time to go out. So he opens, right there in 40 days, Noah opened up the window and the ark that he had made, and he sent out the raven first, and it went to and fro until the waters had dried up in the earth. Right, so what did the raven do?
He flew the coop.
Right, it flew the coop, went around, then just came back, and that was it, and didn't do anything, right? And according to the Midrash, right, Rashi says, why didn't it do anything? Because it was too busy being suspicious of assuming that Noah would try and sleep with its mate, which is super strange, but point being that the raven was not, the orang was not interested in doing what it was told, and therefore, right, so, yeah, not quite exactly what you're looking for. So then we have afterwards what happens instead of the raven, which is, you know, somehow selfish, it doesn't do its job, we then have the dove, right? So then you send out the dove to see whether the waters had decreased from the surface of the ground. The dove could not find a resting place for its foot and returned into the ark, for there was water all over all the earth, right? So again, so notice the difference being is that, you know, note the way that the dove did is it comes back to him as opposed to the raven, which just kind of is, you know, is circling and circling and not, and kind of avoiding Noah the whole time. And then we get moving on, and then says, so then he sent it out again. So clearly the dove did something right. Right, he waited another 7 days, sent out the dove. The dove came back towards the evening, and there in his bill was a plucked up olive leaf. And Noah knew that the waters had decreased on the earth, and they waited another 7 days, sent it the fourth, and did not return to him anymore. Okay, so here we see the dove, the Yonah, being sent off by Noah. We see it doing as it's told and it returning with news as opposed to the Orev, which seemingly comes back with nothing at all. And so therefore it seems that, you know, dove is a very positive bird that's helpful as opposed to the Orev, which is not. So this would also stand for, you know, if we're trying to, you know, pick the archetype of a pure bird versus an impure bird. So Yonah would be a good example for a pure bird, as opposed to the orang, which is one of the non-kosher birds, right? Which is, you know, the raven again is not one of the birds that you can eat, and with, again, in every species of orang is explicitly excluded. Right? All subspecies of orang are definitely no good as well, right? So ravens are on the blacklist. Whether it's because of this or just in general, but clearly, again, we have the dove, which is the positive bird, and then we have the raven, which is the negative bird, right? Black and white, pretty easy to tell the difference here, right? Their plumage tells it all, right? One is white and pure. One is, you know, black as night. So also works both all good and evil motif as well.
It's also a dove can be trained like a dog, and it was used as a messenger. Even in the state of Israel lately, it can be trained to take a message and bring back an answer.
Right, messenger doves, right? So doves are, again, first time it's been used was by Noah, but again, eventually the scaling came up to, it was used, you know, the early air service was not done via airplanes, but was actually done via doves. So, excellent point. Thank you, Rosalma. So, right, so that's how initially, again, doves versus ravens. But the question is that, you know, as far as how negative we want to view the ravens, so don't worry, there are other negative cases, such as in Mishlei, where there's ayin til agla av, tabuz, likhat ein, yikru, or vein asal, yuchlu, v'nei nesher, right? The eye that mocks a father and disdains the homage due a mother, right? The ravens of the brook will gouge it out, the young nesher will devour it. So here we have basically we have a raven taking the role of a scavenger, and basically attacking passerbys who are by the river quite violently. So again, not necessarily. Right, so this is how bad being disrespectful to your parents is. Hi, Ma. So again, so there's that as opposed to the right thing to do. Right, so if you do the wrong thing, right, you'll have your eyes pecked out by ravens. Right, which is not necessarily what you want. Right, again. Sounds a little Sisyphean, right? Very much, you know, cruel and painful. So not what you want. So yeah, so rave is definitely not viewed positively in this verse either. But there is a verse which seems to indicate that actually that it's not as black and white as we thought. So that verse is the story with Eliyahu HaNavi, right? So Eliyahu HaNavi, after he has decreed there be no more water in all of Israel because of Ahaz's idolatrous ways, and the rest of the Jewish idolatrous ways. So then we have him being sent to hide out by God. Right? So here we have the beginning of the story where after Eliyahu had said, there will be no more dew or rain except for at my bidding. So then God told him, leave the place and go hide in Wadi Cherith, and you'll drink from the Wadi, and I command the ravens to feed you there. So Eliyahu went there as God had told him, and he went and he stayed by the Wadi, which is east of the Jordan, right, Nahal Creek. And then the ravens brought in bread and meat every morning and every evening, and he drank from the wadi. So seemingly here, this should teach us that ravens aren't black and white, right? Ravens, you know, might be selfish, but sometimes that selfishness is good if they're, you know, taking care of you as well. So that would be a good theory, but that's not what the commentators tend to interpret it as. For instance, here we have the Mitzvot David, who says, right, why did God send ravens? Not because ravens are, you know, doing something positive. Rather, it's to arouse the spirit of Eliyahu so that he will not be cruel to Israel. As he sees the cruel ravens being compassionate and sustaining him, how could he not have compassion on Israel? Right? Basically, this was a way of God telling Eliyahu, you are worse than ravens, right? You say that, oh, you care, that you don't care, right? You're actually quite cruel. So, and that's a really big problem. So the reason why ravens are being used isn't to show that ravens have multifaceted personalities. It's simply to show just how unyielding Eliyahu and Navi is being to the Jewish people. Because, right, again, true, the Jews were pretty bad at this point, but as in taking away their water and then going away to hide, right? He should have realized that maybe he should, you know, try a little harder in terms of getting them to repent, as opposed to simply, you know, condemning them and then running away. So, but on the other hand, right, we have some, there is some arson verses that seem a little positive towards ravens, right? So this is from a pasuk in Iyov, right? Who provides food for the raven when his young cry out to God and wander about without food? Right? So saying God is stepping in for the role of providing food for the ravens. Right? So it seems to be maybe this is a reward for the way they behaved with, you know, with Eliyahu and Avi maybe. But that's not really the case. Here's the Malbim's commentary, right? Explaining what's going on here with God feeding the raven and why not? So he says, the Malbim says that providence also extends to the raven, traditionally regarded as one of the meanest of beasts. It gives cattle their food to the raven's offspring too when they cry out, right, a parallel verse to our verse here. The United States has asserted that when the raven has offspring, the male tells the female that another bird impregnated her, and so they despise and abandon the young. What does the Holy One Blessed Be do? He ordains the midges or the flies for them, so they come out. So then these flies come out of their excrement, and then they can eat them and survive. So besides that, that is a little nauseating. So this is a very perplexing passage, right? So here we see that God provides even for the cruelest of people, or in this case, animals. So again, we see the degree of the depth that ravens go, right? Ravens are, again, the story from the Gemara is quite cruel, right? They deliberately, the father raven deliberately has the mother abandon its young. And yet still, God still provides for them. So it shows a message that, well, God will provide for whoever, no matter, for everybody, no matter how wicked you may be. But it also is definitely playing up that the fact the raven is perhaps the most wicked that there is. So in general, if you ever were to see a raven being drawn, it is generally not a positive, with positive connotations. Well, yes, it is true that it is quoted sometimes in more positive imagery, such as when in Shir HaShirim, where the dode, meaning where the male beloved's hair is described as being black like a raven. Even though in general ravens aren't positive there, you can say it's positive-ish, because at least there we're referring to the fact that, you know, we're just referring to the cup for color. We're not meaning, again, because they're black as night, which again has its own positive attributes, but it's not necessarily something you actually want. Okay. So the next question we then have, right? So again, we went through, you know, when Nesher is pretty bad, well, some might seem redeeming, but it is just as everybody thought, ravens are pretty bad and dark, and redeeming qualities, they don't have many of them. On the other hand, we have one that probably does have a lot of redeeming qualities, despite it being a non-kosher bird, which is the Nesher, right? So for instance, that is the bird of choice we use to describe the way that the Jews leave Egypt. God says that I have borne you out upon the winds of eagles and brought you to me. Often it uses a tagline for El Al, for their birds in the sky, as they bring people in Aliyah.
There is something very interesting here. Why is Al? Because most of the birds are watching their babies under their wings, but the Nesher, the eagle, nobody can fly higher than the eagle. So the eagle can keep, you know, or watch the babies on the wings. Al kanfei Nesharim.
Correct. You jumped the slide. Excellent. Right. So that's Rashi on the.
Yes. Right? That's from Rashi. Right.
Rashi Dvarim Lamed Bet Yud Bet in the. Nesher arousing its nestlings, flooding out his young, so too God spreads out his wings and takes us, bearing him along his pinions, meaning on his back. Okay? So again, exactly as Rahama just said, right, that is the amazing parts of the Nesher is the way that it carries its young on its back, because it flies higher than the rest of the birds and is not worried about another bird attacking it. But unfortunately, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's necessarily an eagle. Because the confusion about its identification has been going on for over millennia. Tosfot comments that, you know, people will call you an eagle, but he thinks that they're wrong. Right? He thinks that an eagle is a different bird, which we'll get to later. But right. And
actually, in 1949 and 1950, when there the Jews from Yemen, happening was called that they came al kanfei Nesharim.
Correct, right? They called that
kanfei Nesharim. That's when they came from.
Right. That was the name of the mivtza. Correct. Right. The operation when they brought them in. Correct, right? So the question we're going to try and get to is, again, we know some of the connotations of a nesher being a nesher is, you know, rises above majestically. It protects its young, right? It's seemingly the king of all the, of all flying creatures. But the question is, well, what creature is it? So to that, we have to take, so we have to, you know, right? So here's some of the connotations that, that we've seen so far, just from the two verses out of, there's well over 20 in Tanakh that describe the Nesher, not including all of these statements in the Talmud and Midrash, right? Then we get up into the hundreds, right? So, right, many references to Nesher. The question is, so what is the Nesher? So there's two main schools of thought. One is the eagle, as was mentioned by Ruhama, right, which is the opinion of the Sefer Ha'itur, the Chizkuni, and the Yalkut Malam Lois. On the other hand, we have the griffin vulture, which is the position championed by Rasadigon, you know, from the 10th century, by Ibn Ezra from the 12th century, as well as by many modern commentators, such as Yehuda Felix, known as Yehuda Felix, who is known for being well-known for matching up various imagery in Tanakh with the local fauna and wildlife. Right? That's, you know, what he did best, amongst his other academic things. Like, so again, if you want to see a full in-depth explanation of this, you can see it in the, there's a short article by Identity of the Nesher by Natan Slifkin online. I was hoping it was one of the books that he's put out, but it turns out that one never got put in one of the books. And the Nesher, I didn't see it in there. Was it in there? Because I didn't see it in there as one of the entries. Like, I have the book. It wasn't. I don't think that article is in there. It's only on wild animals. He was planning to put out a book on birds. It never actually got printed, as far as I know, unfortunately. I thought I was looking for it, and then I couldn't find it. Nevertheless, it didn't exist yet because it never got printed. Maybe it'll come out in the future. But again, you can see the article online on Zootora.com. Link is there. Again, if somebody wants the PowerPoint, it'll be I'll post it. I'll post it at the end, or feel free to email me and I'll send it to you as well. Okay.
There is also another thing that is both the Nesher and the Dove and the Yonah. They both keep their mate for life.
Right. So, well, correct. Right. That. Unfortunately, many birds have that trait, so it's not necessarily as unique as one would hope. But there are other comparisons as well, such as in terms of them being cooked. The one considered to be kosher as a non-kosher animal, which we will. I don't know if we have time to discuss. For more on that, again, please see Rabbi's article. We'll discuss some more of the technical aspects. That, again, in the interest of time, I see we're already 25 minutes in, so we will not be able to. I don't think we'll get to them this evening. But again, please see the article. Again, I'll post the PowerPoint. So as far as what exactly some of the supports are for why I'm going one way or the other way, so some of the things you have to deal with are certain phrases that seem to imply that the, you know, eating of carrion being a little gross, to say the least. Okay, so this is an Eov where God is describing, you know, again, this is after there's been the whole debate between Eve and all his friends about God's, you know, doing justice and not in the world or not. So then finally God steps in and starts speaking. And he says, talking to Eve and his friends, and he says, does the Nesher rise up at your command and make its nest on high? It dwells and abides on the rock, upon the crag of the rock and the strong place. From there it seeks the prey, and its eyes behold from far away. Its young ones gulp blood, and where their carcass is, there it is. So, which implies very much so that a Nesher is a carrion eating bird, right? The only issue is that that's generally not the way we would refer to an eagle. Eagles tend to not be, you know, if you have, you know, this dead animal that's rotting on the side of the road, you don't expect to see an eagle attacking it. You expect to see a vulture attacking it. So, it would not, so then, well, yes, that would, you know, again, in terms of the residing on cliffs, yes, eagles and falcons also do that as well, but as far as the being a carrion bird, so not quite. So that would be a problem for the identifying it as for the Nesher as being a an eagle. Additionally, there's also And again, another one and related to that is the Mishle, which says, as we recorded before, about the one that's busy eating out the eyes of the animals. So, again, so that verse, again, that includes the Nesher in addition to the raven. And generally, you'll see ravens circling dead prey. You'll see vultures circling dead prey, meaning like, you know, rotting carcasses. But you'll not see an eagle doing that. Eagles tend to, you know, take their prey whole and then take it off and eat it somewhere else. So would not be an eagle, unfortunately. Another issue is that fact that in Mishnah it's described as being bald, right? So it says, shear off your hair and make yourself bald. For the children, you the ones to let it in. Make yourself as bald as a Nesher, for they have been banished from you. So yes, everybody may be remembering that I showed in the picture a bald eagle. But remember that a bald eagle is most certainly not bald, right? It has hair, it's just white. For all those with white hair, they'll be offended if you call them bald. Again, it's just white hair. It's not being bald, right? As opposed to the vulture, as you can see, is definitely lacking in the hair category. And also the other issue is that the bald eagle is native to North America, so probably would not be a bird referenced in the Middle East, because it had yet to be out of that point in time. So then another issue is in regards to mentioned before about the Rashi quoted about how the Nesher carries his bird on his back and it's not scared of any animals. So the question is, what birds fly the highest? We have in Ovadia, in the beginning of his prophecy, where he's talking to Edom, and he says, you know, going against him in battle, and it says, and it talks about how high up in pride the Edomites are before they're going to be squashed. For the pride of your heart has deceived you, you who dwell in the clefts of the rock, whose temptation is high, who said in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? Though you soar aloft like the Nesher, and though you set your neck among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says the Lord. Right? So here we have, right, we have Ovadia, one of the Triasar, one of the 12 prophets, at the very end of the book, at the very end of the section of prophets on Tanakh, right, the end of Nevi'im. So we're saying that the Nesher flies highest. So the highest bird that's ever recorded is actually a griffin vulture that collided with an airplane at 39,000 feet above the ground. So that's the highest known, you know, sighting of a bird confirmed. So again, it seems like the Nesher would be the highest bird at this point. At certain places that might belong to the eagle, but not necessarily. But then now that I've unfortunately, you know, seemingly taken the eagle out of Tanakh, don't worry, it's still there. Because many people would say that the eagle actually is known as the Nates or the Ait. Right? So again, this is the opinion of Professor Yehuda Felix and others that so we see here that there's again here are three of the I think eight times that Ait comes up in Tanakh. That Bayard Hayat of Karim, Bayesho Tam Avram, right? This is by the Brit of Tarim, where birds were again, translation here from JPS is saying that it's the birds that break him down and Avram broke them away. So again, the question is it general birds of prey or is it a specific bird? So again, since these are freshly slaughtered animals, right? So again, so it's not worried about it being carrion and being, you know, and it being like we had before, rather these are, you know, actual, you know. If an animal didn't come and take these away, I'd be surprised because, you know, you just left fresh meat on the ground, which makes sense that Avram had to keep them away from waiting for God to accept the korban. Similarly, it says that no bird of prey knows the path to it, and the falcon's eyes are gazed upon it. So the Hebrew being natiploy the u'ayit lo shizav to ein ayah, right? So you may recognize ein ayah for being one of Cook's books, but it also is referring to the right, so the falcon as well as the eagle's eye looking from afar, because again we know that again because these are birds the prey that generally have been seen to be stalking looking far away before they attack their prey. And similarly we have that unfortunately the way that the Jews were acting towards God. The way that a eagle acts towards its prey, the ayit, right? The way that an eagle tracks. So it's a similar thing. So then, because we acted that way towards God, God will then take revenge upon us. So again, not necessarily the most positive imagery there, but again, clearly you see there that there is an ayit, which is again a bird of prey, often identified as being the eagle, as being the, you know, the violent strong beast coming over the horizon. Again, not necessarily always positively, but again, definitely a strong bird. Again, so don't worry, eagle is still in Tanakh, and a lot of the imagery it still works. Just don't call it a nesher, call it an ayit or a nez. So don't worry. If you any imagery you think using eagles, it still more or less works the same. Just as far as which animal you want to call the king of birds, well, that isn't necessarily accurate. Okay. So now that that's the section we have on Nesher. Okay, so now the next section we're going to try and get to is the Knaaf Renanim. Okay, so this is, again, from Eov. Eov is known for, again, the section where God is describing parts of nature. So, again, a lot of this is very hard to understand, with a lot of words that are relatively rare. So we're going to try our best to go through it. Again, we're going to go through it largely in English, which is from JPS 1985. And again, look at some of it. I'll read the Hebrew when, you know, I'll say the words are particularly strange that then and people debate about what the meaning is. So for the first verse, I have to read in Hebrew because that's the name, right? Knaaf Renanim Na'asa Imev Rachatida Benotza, right? So the Knaaf Renanim, right, beats its wings joyously, right? And her pinions and its plumages are like the storks. Right, are they like that? So, right. So, questions. Is that said as, you know, an exclamatory remark? Is it meant to be rhetorical? Is it a question? Not really a question. You can debate that. The commentaries debate that as well. Is this an identifying feature or a non-identifying feature? Yeah. So they debate whether that's the case or not. And then we have then we continue on, and she leaves her eggs on the ground, letting them warm in the dirt, forgetting they may be crushed in your foot or trampled by a wild beast. Her young are cruelly abandoned as if they were not hers. Her labor is in vain for lack of concern. For God deprived her of wisdom, gave her no share of understanding, else she would soar on high, scoffing at the horse and its rider. So the question is, throughout these verses, what can we extract from the traits of a Knaaf Renanim? So what do we know about it?
It abandons its young and it thinks it's putting it in the sand and that'll be okay, but not realizing that it would get trampled. So,
right. So that means that
not thinking of the dangers.
Right. So it's viewed as being a relative, not the smartest of birds. It is laying its nest and eggs are on the ground, right? Either laid on the ground or in the ground.
No maternal instinct.
Right. Seemingly no maternal instinct whatsoever. And also seems like it could, the question at the last part, Ka'ep Amaram Tamri, right? Else she would soar on high. Does that mean that it does fly or doesn't fly is also an excellent question that you can debate, right? Because depending on that, right, depending on how you read that, will affect the options for what we think it is. So now let's try and take a look at what some of those options are. So the first option that we're going to look at is that of from the Gemara, right? The Gemara identifies this with one of the more mythological beasts, that of the Bar Yochmi, right? So here at the Gemara in Bechorot, which says that once an egg of the bird of the Kolbar Yochmi fell, and the contents of the egg drowned out 60 cities and broke 300 cedar trees. And then the Gemara asks, wait, since when does this giant Bar Yochmi bird throw its eggs to the ground? Isn't it written, the Knaaf Renanim bird rejoices, but are her wings and feathers those of the stork, for she leaves her eggs on the earth and warms them in the dust. So the sages understood the Knaaf Renanim is another name for the Bar Yochmi bird. If so, how could its eggs fall if it lays its eggs on the ground, right? If it's a bird that's laying its eggs on the ground, what's going on here? The answer is that no. Why was it thrown down and caused all this destruction? Because the egg, what Ravashi said, that egg was infertilized, so therefore it was thrown to the ground in anger because it would never hatch. So this is the one option. Again, it's the mythical Bar Yochmi, which is a giant bird whose feet touch the ground and its head reach towards the heavens. So that is one option, right? Which would fit, because also as part of what the and Eov also mentioned there are the Leviathan and Behemoth, right? The Leviathan and the Behemoth, right? Those massive beasts are mentioned there as well. So that's to say that this is simply part of that grouping as well. Therefore, it has no actual identification for with an actual animal. But that is the opinion of the Gemara, but it is not the opinion of many of the commentators. So the first opinion let's look at is one of a more modern commentator, that of Menachem Dor, who suggests the crested lark featured here. And he says, and some of his proofs for it are, he leaves his eggs on the ground despite being able to fly. Yeah, so that's the one that everybody agrees that if the animal does not leave its eggs on the ground, it can't be a viable option. And he adds that it's a songbird, right? Similarly, go back to the verses, right? So we have the comparison to the Chasida and to the Notzah, and we say that it would go up and laugh at the horses and its riders. So that implies that its laughing is often interchangeable with singing. So it has to be a bird that's singing, and if it's not singing, then clearly like that just can't be the right one. Everybody here has ever been to the zoo. Right. So again, there are some birds that sound nice and other birds that, well, they don't sing. They just, screech and howl. Right. So if you want a bird that's happy, right, a happy bird is a singing bird, as I'm sure everybody would agree. Nobody wants a bird that's going like squawk. It's like, no, like that's not a happy bird. It's a bird that you want to, shoo away as fast as possible. So that's why it should be a songbird. So along similar lines, we have the Mitzvah David suggesting a peacock. Again, for the question is, why is the bird a joyous bird? And he says it's not a joyous bird because it's being a singing bird, rather because why is it a peacock? Because it is called Renanim, because it is happy and joyful, because it's always so beautiful, right? The beautiful plumage of the peacock, so therefore it's always a happy bird. Alternatively, he suggests that it might be a type of stork, right? And therefore, then, so not because of the way it looks, but also because so much of the previous one mentioned of being a songbird, right? So again, those are some other options. But again, that's probably not the one that most people here are thinking of. So here's another more rare bird. To be honest, I'd never seen this bird until I was looking this up. This bird is a little freaky looking. So again, notice it's got long legs, right? So it does look a little strange. So would fit with the whole, this bird is a little bit off, like it looks a little crazy, right? So the description of flying through the air while provoking the hunters is referring to the divergent representations and tactics the mother makes when the nest is threatened. So as far as the bird seeming like it's crazy and abandoning its children, it's not that it really is. It's just that, when it sees, like it tends to act crazy when there's a predator, which is associated with having abandoned, it looks as if it's abandoned its young, when it actually has not.
I don't know, in the English translation, they don't translate the word notzah. Notzah is actually a quill, and actually you use it to write Sefer Torah.
Correct. But there's always the question of how to translate biblical words ends up being a large debate, right? Because it means feather or plumage, but depending on the usage, right? It could mean either, and also the word, the term of notza meaning the feather being used for quill is more of a Talmudic usage, is not seen at any point in the usage in Tanakh. So oftentimes, so there's always a question of can you use, Aramaic / Mishnaic Hebrew, is that a valid explanation for what a word in Tanakh means? And that's a whole separate debate, but you're correct, right? So then, it's called, the bird's feathers are called notzah, which is then the name also for the quill. Which came first and how is an excellent question for a linguist, but again, a little bit beyond the scope of our time that we have today. I'd like to get to the next option is a little more popular, is that of the ostrich, which is the opinion of the Malbin for Peter Felix and others. For more on that, please hop over to the Wikipedia page to see a full list of names. Again, there are links in the slideshow that I'll post at the end. So again, so according to the commentators on the Anas Mishnah, right, she cannot fly to the heights of the stork, and four, they're in the lower lays, nogs lays eggs in the sand and depths of the earth because it came from the stork who placed her nest in the cypress. Basically, here, sorry, that's a whole bunch of technical jargon that's not necessarily helpful. Point being is that Malman differentiates between the ostrich, he says, because again, it can't fly, right? Is it, why is it called Kanaf Ranim? It's because it flaps its wing, but it does nothing. So that's the way it's, you know, being joyous in that way compared to the stork. Stork flies, but this does not. And similarly, we do know that ostriches do lay their eggs in the sand. And then we also know that ostriches, if we had to say which bird looks a little crazy, so ostriches definitely would, you know, or like looks like it lost some brain cells. Ostriches definitely would be one, especially if you've ever seen an ostrich when it's trying to hide its head in the ground. When there's a predator, you're also going like, you're huge, why don't you run away? You're not hiding well at all. I know your head's in the ground, but come on. Right? So it's fun to say a bird that's crazy, right? So that's definitely an option. So then another question that comes up related to that, you know, what the identification of Kanaf Ranim is, comes up in regards to what is the, as we discussed the Beit Alpha mosaic. The question is, what is the bird? You see here, there's this bird flanking the Aron, right? So we see that there are lions, there's lions flanking it, which we mentioned in a previous lecture. It refers often to the angels, parallel being next to God. So then we have the menorah, which also fits well as well, because that's in the temple. The question then is, well, what are these birds doing here, right? We've got the Arbaminim, makes sense why they're there, but why on earth would you want to have birds there? So part of that comes down to what we mentioned just now about the Kanaf Ranim, and the fact that that if they are birds that God describes, you know, as being somehow unique in his description of, you know, what he controls and doesn't control, it would stand to reason there also are birds that are located near him. Which is also why there's two opinions that I saw up to what it might be. So we have Professor Eliezer Zucanic, who says that it's going to be an ostrich. Again, related to the interpretation we had before, as well as Professor Haffili, who goes to the opinion of being a peacock. Again, one of the opinions mentioned earlier as well. Okay, so now just to quickly sum up what we've covered in terms of some of the animals and what they may represent, being positive or negative. So yes, we have the dove, which is the kind, generous, peace-loving, bearer, good news bird, right, that we all like. On the other hand, we have the ravens, which are known for being selfish and cruel. And even when they think they might be good, so it appears that that Chazal and the commentators go out of their way to say that actually Noah was actually wicked. Then we have we discussed what the Nesher was, whether it's a eagle or a griffin vulture. We discussed, you know, how it definitely is the king of beasts, flies higher and is very protective. And we discussed how even if, you know, the Nesher might not be an eagle, but again, the gambit of violent predators is still there, predatory birds is still there, just some of them might have to be grouped under Ayin or other birds in the list of Nesher animals. And lastly, we discussed the case of the Kanaf Ranim, this distinctive bird that God is that God describes. Right, so we saw that it might be mythical by Yochni, to be a giant, which is not so useful. Then we saw some other options of ground-laying birds, namely that of the crested lark, Eurasian stone curlew, the peacock, or the ostrich. And we discussed why, one way or the other way, each of them could be an option that might fit. And then we discussed, based on, you know, the fact, based on which one that is, would also help enlighten us as to which bird we think is one of the birds that would be near God. In addition to the options of the Nesher, but there's going to be another bird, so that would be a reason as to why we'd want to have that other bird be located in our mosaic and decorations of our synagogues. So if anybody has any questions relating to birds, feel free to ask them now. And also next week, we're hopefully going to be covering the writing of God's name. So if anybody has, basically because there was an artist about a week and a half ago who had the brilliant idea of actually burning a burning God's four-letter name for the sake of art. So we're going to discuss what on earth was he thinking, why that was a terrible idea, and whether or not you're allowed to use the name of God in a forbidden purposes, or whether or not that is generally frowned upon.
The peacock, they say that the peacock was brought to Israel from King Shlomo for his palace, whatever. Is there any mention in the Tanakh of this, or is this just Midrash?
I believe it's a Midrash. I don't think that's any mention of Tanakh of there being having that.
I just wanted to know what if it was in the Tanakh.
I can look at the gifts that were brought by Queen Sheba. But I don't recall.
Okay. Also, is there anything negative about the dove listed in the Tanakh?
Like the dove. I haven't seen anything negative.
Henry?
Wait a second. I've got a concordance here. I'll check up the usages. I don't think there's anything negative.
And also with the dove, you said something about it being peaceful. How did it become a peace symbol?
So that's a good question. So some would say that it became a peace symbol thanks to historian Noah. Alternatively, the question is whether or not it existed as one independently of that in other cultures, which it has. And there's always the question of which one came first with ancient cultures. So it's one of those you can't really determine it. Yeah, so here, so as far as it being a positive bird, yeah. So again, the yonah also uses korbanot frequently. It is used in some negative prophecies, but it's not viewed as being a negative meaning in terms of, let's say, the coming of a shore. I'm seeing here, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's necessarily negative. Which means that usher is described as a yonah. That's in.
It doesn't answer the question of Elaine, but what is interesting is that the yonah came back with a branch of a olive tree, and and the olive tree is a very very strong tree that survived the flood. And they became a symbol of the state of Israel. The two olive branches on the side. It's because it is a symbol of peace and survival. The olive tree, the olive branch that the yonah came. Right. Why the olive branch?
Right. So that's the
flood. You know, it's a. The olive tree is a very strong, can survive all kind of weather and all kind of, so after the flood, she came with a branch of it's anaf zait, the fear.
Very nice. Yes, but I checked it. That was more comparing the Assyrians being weak like a dove, meaning that they flutter like a dove, as in it was an expression of frailty. So it wasn't necessarily a negative connotation there. It was a curse to Ashur. So the yonah is still a positive bird, just it's not a predatory bird. If you're calling your enemies a dove, that's not that you're no longer scary.
Mm-hmm.
So that was usage. I didn't see anything negative about a yonah.
There is also something general about birds there is a time that of the bird migration. Nedigata tziporim, a certain climate when they move from one place to the other, and they know how to get. They don't need a GPS. They are very. They know the way out of a certain climate. Correct. and come back. It's the right. Migration. Yes.
Yeah, so they're able to migrate. I haven't seen anything in terms of that being drawn upon, at least in any rabbinic sources, as far as
I know, but I know I was a bird watcher in Israel, and I am from Israel.
Very nice.
Yeah.
So, was the stork ever any symbolism in art?
Not that I saw that in the Chassidah. So, as in, not again, I haven't seen it in any artwork. I mean, there's something called the bird mosaic, which has a lot of birds in it. That's found in Caesarea. But that wasn't necessarily in any way to tell anything about that. Simply has many birds that are in the area, of which one of them is historic, as well as flamingos and other ones also. But because it wasn't used in a motif, but it was just birds at the mosaic, it was a little inconclusive as to its ancient usage.
And the birds in Beit Alpha, what were they? Did they figure out what the birds they were?
So there's two options that I saw, namely that of the peacock or that of the ostrich. As far as which one it looks like, again, as you can tell by their drawing of lions, like the person doing the mosaic wasn't the best artist. So as in like, it's a little hard to tell based on the actual shape of the bird or its coloring either, because yeah, their lion coloring is a little bit off too. So basically based on what you thought would be a bird next to God. And so whether or not you thought that it was, you know, compared to being the case of Kanafranim, whatever that would be. Or if you wanted it to be like one of the, let's say the face of an eagle, let's say like the four faces of the angel is another option, the face of a Nesher. But the problem with that being is that it wasn't really done as motifs back in that time period, at least among Jewish sources. So that's why they mixed the Nesher option. Because that was more of a griffin.
I mentioned at the beginning the mitzvah of Kantzipor from Sefer Dvarim. Right. A bird has a feeling also. If you want to take the eggs or the baby bird, you have to send her first, not in her present, to take her children. So it's a very interesting that the bird has a feeling also.
Correct. Yeah, that seems to be one of those ones where it's interesting though, but even though you send it away, you still take the eggs. So you're doing a slight kindness, but you're not doing a full kindness. The full kindness would be not taking the eggs. So there's also a question as to why Tilly Shulchan is also viewed as being a chok, being a law that doesn't have a good reason, because the logic doesn't fully follow through.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting case. But yeah, so I was looking for the Chasida in Tanakh. So it seems like they had anything.
With the Chasida, I always wondered why Rashi seems so critical about the name, because the Chasida, because it shows Chasidut like toward its own kids only, right? You know what I mean?
Correct.
But every animal's like that. Every animal prefers its own kind.
Correct, but there's also different degrees of it being. Meaning, the question is why it's a non-kosher bird and it gets the name Chesed, right? So, as in, like being called kind while being called impure, it's like that means there's something wrong with your kindness, right? So, as in, if it was truly kind, it would be like, let's say, like the dove, which is kosher, right? Dove, which is a kind bird, right? It brought back the olive branch, and it's used in Karbana. The fact that it's specifically excluded means that it might do acts of kindness, but it only does it for itself, which is why it's excluded. Because it sounds like it should be very, again, also think of the babies on the stork, which is, again, is a weird, because that itself is a whole weird thing. Why on earth that's a thing? But no, it's not Jewish at all. It's the whole like baby on a stork thing. It's like, no, it's not remotely Jewish. But again, it is something that's seen in culture, so worthy of mention, but it's just simply not something that's standard or normal. So
I think there should be more art of kmitza. That would be really fun to have on your wall. You know, to have an illustration like that. That would be fun.
Yeah, that would be that would be hard to yes. So. So, graphic art is always hard to draw it properly. So next week, again, we're going to be continuing with, let me turn the recording.